Greetings, Earthlings. Welcome to Voices from the Real World. Profile Theater is a theater company located in Portland, Oregon. Profile Theater centers the season around a season-long featured writer. Our best artists help us see. And at Profile, each year, we use a different writer's unique perspective as a lens that helps us see our shared world in new and surprising ways. Community Profile is an affinity space built around the structure of a free writing workshop. Participants in Community Profile meet, write, support, share, and bear witness to other people who may have walked a mile in their shoes. In Community Profile, we feature writers who have won awards and had numerous books published, as well as writers who are making their first foray into expressing themselves on paper. The result is writing that is singularly personal, provocative, powerful, moving, funny, tragic, beautiful, and that encapsulates the entirety of the human experience. What this podcast does is give those writers, those creators, a chance to share their life stories and their writing in a public forum so that we can celebrate and appreciate victories that have been won and challenges that have been overcome by people whose lives you may recognize or be experiencing for the very first time.
Hello, and thank you for listening to Voices from the Real World. I'm Tamara Carroll, Profile's Director of Community Engagement, and today we are bringing you a special episode. This is an interview I recorded with Dr. Jane Vogel-Montry almost a year ago. At that time, Dr. Montry was just about to publish her memoir, See Jane Run, A Primer on Love, Resilience, and the Indo-American Dream, in which she talks about her Indo identity, her father's determination to bring their family to the United States, and the story of her name, Jane. She also talks about her plans to launch a fundraiser to enable her to travel to Indonesia with a documentary crew and visit some important landmarks from her past. Today, Jane is recently back from that trip to Indonesia, and her book is available to the public. It was a real privilege to have Jane as a member of our Community Profile cohort last year and to sit down with her for this interview. I hope you enjoy. Jane, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
It's my privilege and pleasure.
Wonderful. So I would love for you to just tell us a little bit about yourself. Just tell us your story.
My name is Jane. I am a retired actor now. I am also a retired trauma psychologist. I'm a badass activist. I'll never retire from that. And I'm in the process of writing my memoir, and there's a documentary being made on it, which is very exciting. And that is my story, and I'm sticking with it.
I believe every word of it, and can affirm the badassery of your activism for sure. This is your first time participating in the Community Profile cohort, right?
Yes.
Amazing. And what drew you in? What led you to want to participate?
I'm a big fan of Profile Theater. I have had good friends who have participated in previous cohorts and have had amazing experiences. And I've always wanted to participate. And when this opportunity came up to do some writing around being an immigrant, I thought, oh my gosh, the timing is just perfect.
One of the activities that we started the cohort with that I thought would be interesting if all of the folks from this cohort shared was we did an activity called The Story of Your Name, which is actually activity I love to start new groups with. It's both a interesting, you know, just a fun way to get to know each other, but I think it also starts to unpack a lot of these ideas about where our names
come from, what kind of hopes or intentions for us the people who name us have. So I had folks partner up and share any story that they wanted to tell about their name. Could be their first name, their last name, a nickname, a name they no longer use. And yeah, I'm excited for our participants to share that story. Would you be willing to share the story of your name that you shared on that day?
I would. My name, Jane, has a lot of meaning to it. I was named Jane by my father. I was born in Indonesia, and I was born in the early 1950s. My father had spent many, many years already trying very hard to get to America. He and my mother had lived through two wars, and it was very dangerous to be there. And yet there was an Asian ban in the United States. And when I was born, my father was so determined to come to America that he said my name would be Jane. And unfortunately, even with a daughter named Jane, he didn't get in. And so we finally had to go to Europe, to the Netherlands, and we waited there. And we waited for 6 very long, cold years. And then a church brought us over to America. And I didn't speak a word of English. I was 7 years old. And a few weeks after we arrived, I started school. I was scared to death. but I opened the textbook, and the word that jumped off the page was Jane. It was "See Jane Run." And I had no idea what that meant. I thought it meant something like "Welcome to America." And so that is the story of my name.
It's sort of tremendous foresight in a way, or I don't know, kismet, right? But this idea that the kind of the first thing you would see in this very like strange place that could be incredibly unwelcoming feeling is like your name in a book, and how seen it made you feel, like you were being welcomed. It makes me think of all the discussions and effort that's gone into making sure that there is a diverse cultural representation in our educational materials, right? So that everybody can see their name in a book and know that they're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any particular feelings? I was just listening about the end of Title 42. I don't know if that's something that you're following or not. And yeah, any thoughts you'd want to share about that?
I have a lot of thoughts. You know, interestingly, immigrants, statistically, once they get here, they often take on conservative political positions, which surprises me. And within my own family, I have known that to be true. And when there have been discussions about immigration, and I think, goodness, although I was 7 years old, the trauma of being a refugee lives forever in my body. And so I have tremendous empathy for anyone who is fleeing their homeland. And when you flee your homeland, it's not because you hate your homeland. It's because your life is in danger. And one of the things I often hear from fellow immigrants is, yes, but we came over legally. And my parents are gone. My father's sister did not make it out. She was, horrible things were done to her before she died. And I don't know what my father would have done if he couldn't have gotten legal passage to America. I don't know. I know that he would have done anything and everything to keep his family alive.
I would think that people who are immigrants themselves would have a heightened awareness of the reasons that people fight so hard to get into the United States. But I wonder to what extent the average person knows the trauma and struggle and barriers that people face. So I'm curious about like what you remember from before you left. I'm curious about if you've been back. I've heard you mention at times that your culture is sort of disappearing.
Yes.
Would you speak to that a little bit?
Yes. There are a lot of people who are intelligent, insightful, who have very little understanding about not just Indonesia, but particularly the Indo culture, which is the culture that is my culture. Indo is a blend of Indonesian and European. And Indonesia was colonized since the late 1500s. And they were colonized by Europeans, predominantly the Dutch, until 1949. And my family specifically arrived in Indonesia in the 1700s, and we were thrown out in the late 1940s. We were given 10 years to Exodus, but during those 10 years, there were massacres. And so we had a choice of, because I am Indonesian through my grandmothers and great-grandmothers. I am also of Dutch citizenship through the colonizers from the 1700s. They kept the citizenship in our particular family. But we did not choose to become Indonesian because of the murders that happened in our family. And then my father never identified as Dutch either because of the racism that our family and friends experienced as Indos. So we didn't really have an identity other than Indo. And that is why my father said, we are going to become Americans. That is going to be our identity. And so as soon as we finally got to the United States, we were told we had to assimilate. After I was here for about a year, my father, who I use the word forbid, he forbid me to do a lot of things. And that sounds harsh, but he was the most gentle, amazing man. His whole goal in his life was to keep me and his family safe. And I will honor him all the days of my life and my mother. But he forbid us to speak Dutch, the children. That was the national language of Indonesia for those several hundred years. The day we were eligible to become citizens, we became citizens. And we were living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is where a church brought us, in a very Germanic community. People were very white. And we stuck out like sore thumbs. Our homes didn't, our bodies didn't smell like white people's. You know, there's Salisbury steak, whatever that smells like. Well, that's not what came out of our house. You know, we had ginger and garlic smells, and those were the aromas coming out of our house. And people would ask, what are you? Like, are you Chinese? Are you Japanese? And I would have to say I'm an American once I was eligible to say that. But before that, I don't even remember. I think I might have said, I think the one identity we would say is we're immigrants. Mm. That's what we would say. Mm. So I assimilated very well. Education was very important to my parents. And it was very clear to me that there was a lot of sacrifice and suffering in order to get us to where we needed to be. And because I had such love and respect for my parents, I was going to honor their sacrifice. And I identified as an American. And when I moved from Milwaukee to Oregon when I was in my 20s, people stopped asking me, "What are you?" Once in a while, somebody said, "You kind of look like you're Hawaiian." But I didn't really speak much about being Indo. And I married a white American and raised my children on American food and American traditions. And now that my children are our parents and I am going to be 70 this year, I have a real craving to share my culture and to pass some of it down because it is no longer. And so I started writing stories about my life. And Sankar Raman, who founded The Immigrant Story, invited me to tell my story at one of his events. And then I learned that there are many Indos like myself around the country and around the world who are feeling the exact same thing I am. And my story actually that I presented at The Immigrant Story, that story was published internationally, and I've gotten feedback from people in the Netherlands who are now coming this summer to do a podcast on my story. And there's a documentary being done on it as well. And I am just about to self-publish a book that's going to be coming out here very shortly called See Jane Run. And that title is very important. See Jane Run. I told you the story of my name, and that is the first sentence that I learned. But even more importantly, I reminded my father of his sister. And when he died in 1998, I flew to Arizona to say goodbye to him, and he was heavily sedated on morphine. And when he heard my voice, he opened his eyes and he thought I was his sister. And his last words to me were, "Run, run."
That's quite a powerful recollection. Sort of lovely, I think, that conflicting, right? Like that he felt he was able to see his sister again, but still feared for her safety.
Mm-hmm. My father, I always described him as such a courageous, brave man. He was a POW for 4 years. He was on the death railway, captured by the Japanese. He survived that. As much as he was this very gentle, soft-spoken person, he was tremendously courageous. And it was only in the middle of the night when he had night terrors that I knew of his anguish. But during the day, he was my hero. And when he opened his eyes the last time I saw him, it was the first time that I came face to face with the terror in his eyes. And when he said that to me, I said to him, "Papa, it's Jane. It's Jane." And he said again, "Run, run. And then I changed my tactic and I said, I went with what he was with his hallucination. And I said, Papa, I'm strong. I can run fast. You don't have to worry about me. And he said, no, you are very small. Run. And then he closed his eyes. His sister was also very small. And so he was reliving a moment in Indonesia with me. And so that is why my book is entitled See Jane Run.
That's a little bit, feel a little bit heartbroken at not being able to, at the idea of him not being able to, I guess outrun is the word that comes to mind, like those traumas.
Yeah.
To be able to pass having the knowledge that he and you had made it to safety and thrived.
Right, right.
I'd love you to share something from See Jane Run, if you would.
Okay, this is an excerpt from a chapter called They Do Bad Things to Actresses in America. The acting bug bit me when I was 7 years old. We had just arrived in America on a hot August day. Our sponsors from West Granville Presbyterian Church picked us up from this train station, not on tuk-tuks, not on bicycles, but in huge cars, and brought us to our new home in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was a small apartment that the church people lovingly furnished with treasures from their attics and basements, including beds, a couch, a table, and chairs. But best of all, a magic wooden box with a glass window called a TV. The Mickey Mouse Club was one of my favorite television shows. Annette Funicello was my idol. Eventually, I learned that Annette and the other people inside that wooden TV box were called actors. I knew that someday I was going to be inside that TV box. I was going to be an actress. Why did I want to be an actress? Because Annette Funicello laughed and sang and wore pretty clothes. Her world was the opposite of mine. My world was filled with angst and worry and definitely not pretty clothes, except for the dress that Mama had made for me before we left to go to America. If I was an actress on the Mickey Mouse Club, I would not have frequent nightmares which sent me crying into my parents' room in the middle of the night. Mama would tell me to think about happy things and go back to sleep. It was hard coming up with happy thoughts. Until I figured out that I could make up stories with happy endings. There was something magical and empowering about creating stories. I took my stories into the dank basement of our apartment building, set up a stage with empty cardboard boxes, and voila, my acting career was on its way. My first captivated audience was a family of mice that ventured down from the rafters. I gave them names and rehearsed with them. I was the playwright, the director, and the lead actor. I loved creating the characters in my play. Even more so, I loved pretending to be those characters, singing and dancing in our small, crowded apartment. Mama would tell me to settle down. I was being too dramatic. My energy was disruptive to the fragile household that Mama struggled to maintain. I would retreat back into my imagination, planning and plotting my next script. At school, I produced my plays during recess with the kids who didn't want to play dodgeball or hopscotch. It was my favorite part of the school day. At night, I would inhabit my characters as a way of thwarting the nightmares that lurked in the darkness before I slipped into sleep. My stories were my sanctuary, helping me cope with the pervasive existential angst that I felt in our home. Stories gave me respite from the dark clouds that hovered over me and expanded the horizons of my imagination. I would go to sleep at night, putting happy stories into my mind and believing with all my heart that someday I would grow up to be an actor inside that magic wooden TV box. When I was 15 years old, we made one of our long summer road trips to visit family on the West Coast. The aunties and uncles were impressed with my good grades and my precocious ambition. I was taught to be humble, but they asked me about my grades and I told them I was on the A honor roll at school. I also knew exactly what I was going to be when I grew up. I knew where I was going and I was willing to work hard to make it happen. There was so much in my world that seemed out of control. Mama's storms, Papa's night terrors, and bullies. But there were things I could control. I could make Papa proud of me. I could write stories, and I could be whatever I wanted to be when I grew up. The aunts and uncles smiled, obviously pleased with me. The proverbial question from all the relatives that summer before entering high school was, "What are you going to be when you grow up?" And Papa heard me respond with absolute certainty, "I am going to be an actress." We returned home just as the new school year was beginning. After unpacking, Papa said that he wanted to speak with me. Papa was like E.F. Hutton. When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. Papa seldom spoke, but when he did, I listened. Mama said that Papa was always right, and I believed her. Papa stood with me in the narrow hallway of our small house, and he gently took my hand. He had a serious look on his face, and I knew he was going to tell me something very important. I gave him my full attention. "Papa, Jane, you are about to go to high school, and soon you will be on your own. From now on, I forbid you to tell anyone that you are going to be an actress." I stood in silence. "Papa, you see, Jane, they do bad things to women who become actresses in America. You must study hard, get a good job, and never be dependent on anyone for anything. Then you will be safe." More silence. "Papa, Jane, you must promise me that you will be safe." "Yes, Papa. I promise." I knew what bad things happen to women. The men did bad things to Papa's sister before they killed her. It was why we fled Indonesia. He could not bear to have men do bad things to me. He had done his homework. He knew that women in Hollywood often did whatever they needed to do for their directors, their agents, their perpetrators. He knew that the life of an actress in the 1950s and 1960s could be everything that he did not want for me. Papa said that I never had to obey him unless he had a good reason. My safety, Papa's peace of mind, our family's fragile existence depended on me making the right choices. He had good reason, and I would obey him. I honored my Papa, never telling anyone again that I would be an actress until 30 years later when he died.
You waited.
I waited.
You waited until...
until he died.
To start acting.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. My father died. My mother, who was an incredible musician, untrained, sang a beautiful hymn to my father at his funeral. She got in the car with me and she said, "Jane, I'm going with him." And she had a fatal heart attack. And it was then that I took some time off from my practice to do some healing of my own. And during that healing time, that little girl came back to me, singing and dancing. And I said, I'm going to fulfill my promise to her now. And I did.
That's a different, it's a different story of a dream deferred to a happier ending for sure.
Yes.
So prior to becoming an actress, is that when you were
a trauma psychologist? Yes. Helping create safe spaces for children, teenagers, and adults who were survivors of trauma. That is what I did, and I loved doing that. It was incredibly rewarding. And it was only after my father and mother both died that that little girl came back to me and reminded me that there was still something left unfinished. I wasn't thinking at all about that dream. I had really locked it, put it away. And the trauma work I did was very much, I didn't know it at the time I chose to become a trauma psychologist, but it was really about healing myself. Mm. And one of the things, one of my superpowers as a psychologist, as a healer, was that there are some things you can't teach. And what you can't teach is a certain level of empathy. And I always had a connection with the survivors that I worked with, an unspoken connection that I think they felt and I felt. And it was because of what was in my collective DNA as a refugee.
Right. There's understanding and there's knowing. There's I maybe those aren't the two words, but I don't think anyone. There's certain things that you just can't put yourself in that position through imagination. Absolutely.
And particularly when I was doing my training, a lot of the schools of thought on healing was about creating treatment protocols that were based on symptoms and really not listening to the person's story.
Right.
And for people who haven't been through it but who've read all the textbooks, I think it's tempting to want to go straight to the symptom and then look at the research and what is, you know, here are some assignments for you to do, as opposed to really being fully present and listening to the story. And that is the way that I did my work. And it's interesting because when I then devoted my life to theater, the importance of storytelling, the importance of listening, the importance of being fully present and responding to what your scene partner is giving you. I mean, that to me, it fit hand in glove with what I had been doing.
There's a whole branch of, I don't know if it's psychology exactly, but of narrative therapy and a growing body of research around the idea that the act of telling your story has capacity to heal trauma, that there are approaches of writing your story where you write a different ending. What's your thoughts or experience with those kind of approaches to working with folks who've experienced trauma?
I think that the key to healing is to be able to create a safe container, a safe relationship with someone who can hear your story. And yes, the telling of the story changes things, because when a person experiences trauma, they are dehumanized. They are disempowered. They are not heard. They are not listened to. Things are done to them. And it's interesting how many systems we have, including in the medical and the psychotherapy field where we still try to do things to the people, to the patients, to the survivors, as opposed to really creating that space for them to do the work. And that is actually much more difficult to do than to say, here, let me give you a couple of assignments. Let me tell you what you have to do now in order to get out of your funk.
I'm curious whether you feel like America, the United States, whether you feel like the United States was fulfilled the promise, whether it was what your family hoped it would be for you all, for all of you.
The American dream that my parents had was a myth. And yet, I know that when a lot of people speak about, oh, you know, it's so much better in certain other countries, I believe that that's a myth as well. That humanity is wondrous and humanity is flawed everywhere. And I am very grateful to be here in America. And I am very committed to fighting what ails America. I am not someone who wants to be complicit about riding on the coattails of the myths that we are the greatest country in the world. In many ways, we are great, including our capacity to oppress and to do harm.
Agreed. Do you have another passage that you might want to share with us?
I have another excerpt here called I Wish I Had a Turtle. Jerry the Turtle lives at McAdam Dental Clinic near the riverfront in southwest Portland. My toddler granddaughter loves Jerry. She gets giddy riding up and down in the dental chair and opening her mouth wide as the dentist checks her teeth while Jerry looks on and bobbles his head. Going to the dentist is almost as fun as going to the park. She is not dental phobic. Unfortunately, I am. When I go to the dentist, the entire support team of Frankie, Maggie, and Bea is on alert to provide assistance. They are gentle, wise, and sometimes hyperactive canines who patrol the clinic in search of patients like myself who have not had happy encounters with dental care. When I recall my first dental visit, my heart still races and my throat tightens up. I was 7 years old and an abscess had formed on my lower gums below my baby teeth. Mrs. Bletcher, our minister's wife, drove me and Mama to a dental clinic. I laid in a chair with a heavy pad over my chest. Mama stood behind me to my left. The dentist told Mama that he needed to pull several teeth. She became upset and put up two fingers, telling him he could pull only two teeth, but no more. There was a ruckus back and forth exchange between Mama and the dentist, filled with loud voices and Mama crying. The dentist was standing to my left facing Mama and forcefully gesturing. Mama did not back down. I could see the angry dentist's face and neck turning red against his white coat. He did not like Mama telling him what to do. She usually didn't stand up to men in authority, but she was fighting like a mama bear protecting her cub. I started crying with Mama. I could not understand anything the dentist was saying, but I saw Mama flashing two fingers in his face and hearing her yell the word no repeatedly through her tears. The dentist relented, but I was not going to let this man near me. I yelled and kicked and flailed my arms. If I hadn't been flat on my back in the chair, I would have gotten up and ran for the door. In a huff, the dentist called on his staff for help. The room filled with white coats and no smiles. They circled me and strapped my arms to the chair. Two sets of hands strapped my feet together and held them so I couldn't move. White coats held my head, and someone gave me a shot in my mouth that hurt. The dentist took his tools and forcefully pried open my mouth and growled as he yanked two teeth out of my tender gums. Mama was trembling and so was I. Finally, the fight was over and they let me go. We never returned to that clinic again. Sometime later, I was randomly attacked on my way home from school by two boys who lived in the gray and red house across the street from our apartment. They took turns punching me in the stomach and chest, yelling, "Go back to where you came from!" It was the first time I'd ever heard the F word. I didn't know what it meant, but I knew it was really bad. They knocked the wind out of me and ran into their house. I staggered up the stairs, dazed. I opened the door to our apartment and wanted to wail to Mama that I was hurt. But I saw a strange scene in our house that made me hold my breath. Mama was in the living room, surrounded by women from our church, Mrs. Stoneman, Mrs. Matner, and Mrs. Bletcher. Mama was very upset. The worst thing I could do now was cry in front of the church people, so I fought back my tears. I wondered why Mama looked pale and sad. Her fingers twisted and turned, a handkerchief drenched wet with her tears, and she kept wiping her eyes in her forehead. The church people stroked her arms and shoulders like they were trying to make her feel better. Something very bad had happened. Mama turned to me and opened her mouth. Her teeth were gone. I gasped. It was like I was being punched in the stomach all over again. I couldn't breathe. Mama must have gone back to the mean dentist, and he pulled out all her teeth because she wouldn't let him pull mine. Mama's pain rolled over mine like a big ocean wave. I blocked out what the boys across the street did to me, and I went into the small bedroom I shared with my brothers. I waited there alone for a long time while Mama cried with the church people.
Tell me and our listeners about where we're going to be able to find this memoir. And also, I'd love to hear more about if the documentary is something we're going to be able to access.
So this memoir, it is finished, and I have let a few friends and close family members order it. Then I made a few more edits, and this week the final version is going to be uploaded. And the easiest way I can tell you is if you go to the website I founded, Advanced Gender Equity in the Arts, ageinthearts.org. If you go to that website, there will be a link for you to be able to order it. I have self-published it on Lulu Publishing. It is also on Amazon. It's called See Jane Run, A Primer on Love, Resilience, and the American Indo Dream. The documentary is being co-produced by Brenda Foley and Bruce Nelson out of Arizona. I have been contacted by a woman who read one of my stories in here that was published internationally, and she is a law student in Indonesia. She is an activist for women, and she would like me to come and speak to them. She is also interested in taking me to Surabaya. I have never been to Surabaya. I have been to my birthplace of Jakarta. I have never been to Surabaya, which is the place where my aunt was murdered. And I would like to go back there. No one in my family has ever gone back there. And I would like to do that for them.
We will put a link to the website where your book can be found. Is there yet any sort of active fundraiser?
Yes. Brenda has done active fundraising, and my birthday is coming up. My 70th birthday is coming up in July. And so I will also be creating a fundraiser specifically. I'm calling it See Jane Run to Indonesia. So I would really like to be able to, it's a heavy lift to take the documentary crew to Indonesia. Many of the crew are people who are from marginalized communities, and I want to make sure that they are well taken care of, that they are compensated. And so we need to raise the money to make that happen.
Thank you so much for being here and sharing all of this with me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tamara. You are a real gift to all of us and to our community. And thank you, Profile. Thank you.
Dr. Jane Vogel Montree is a retired psychologist, actor, and activist. She's the founder of Advanced Gender Equity in the Arts, or AGE, a Portland-based social justice arts organization created to empower marginalized artists leading with a lens of gender and race. Her memoir, See Jane Run, A Primer on Love, Resilience, and the Indo-American Dream, is now available, and all of the proceeds go to benefit AGE. Jane will be appearing at Profile Theater's Light the Way Gala on April 6th to share a reading from her book. Tickets are available at profiletheater.org.